Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines claims by the White House and from some corporate media outlets that President Bush deserves credit for moves toward democracy now taking place in the Middle East. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who reports on the condition of political prisoners she saw on a recent fact-finding trip she and others made to Haiti, 1 year after the overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And John Walk, with the Natural Resources Defense Council, who takes a critical look at regulations issued by the Bush administration that he says will weaken government clean air standards. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While President George Bush is on the campaign circuit trying to sell his plan to privatize Social Security, elderly pensioners in Moscow are out in the streets protesting cuts in retirement, education, and transit benefits. The mass protests, a rare event in Putin's Russia, began in January after the Kremlin replaced in-kind benefits for 30 million Russian pensioners with a single cash grant. In the process, pensioners lost traditional services, including their right to free rides on public transit, discounted medicines, and housing subsidies. Tensions over the market-based reforms grew so heated, according to the news magazine In These Times, that elderly riders have resisted bus drivers who are demanding fares. Mikhail Delyegin of the Moscow-based Institute for Globalization Studies stated, "This is about slashing government expenditures and removing life support systems for millions of people." In recent weeks, students have led major demonstrations against the Kremlin's plan to cancel all military deferments. Student leaders are also worried that they will lose their right to a free education, a right that is written into the Russian constitution. Despite the protests, Russian President Putin is planning for more market reforms. The pro-Putin majority in the Duma last year passed for the first time in modern Russian history a tenant eviction law. After a three-year boycott of the fast food giant Taco Bell, Florida farm workers are declaring victory. Yum Brands, the owner of Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and the coalition of Immokalee workers signed a deal to raise wages of Florida tomato pickers. According to the Guardian newspaper, the terms include a 1 cent raise per pound of tomatoes harvested, nearly doubling workers' pay for each 32-pound basket picked. Taco Bell has agreed to institute a corporate code of conduct to ensure more humane labor standards. The boycott of Taco Bell was launched by Florida farm workers in 2002 after the fast food giant rejected demands to get contractors to increase wages. Student activists joined the campaign by working to ban Taco Bell from campuses. The company's image was damaged by a hunger strike conducted by farm workers outside its corporate offices in Irving, California. Lucas Benitez of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers hailed the agreement as setting a new standard for social responsibility for the fast food industry, and he says it will make an immediate material change in workers' lives. Three activists with the Rainforest Action Network were arrested and fined on March the 5th after posting signs on telephone poles and trees in Greenwich, Connecticut, home of J.P. Morgan Chase CEO William Harrison. Designed to look like Old West Wanted posters, the flyers read, "Wanted, William Billy the Kid Harrison," and urged his neighbors to ask him to do the right thing by ending investments of mass destruction and adopting environmental standards today. Last year, Rainforest Action Network gained broad concessions from Citigroup and Bank of America, but not from J.P. Morgan Chase. The flyers were meant to draw attention to the company's alleged financing of environmentally damaging projects like mining and logging. Within half an hour of posting the flyers, the activists Bob Nixon, an old Greenwich resident and senior news editor of Between the Lines radio news magazine, and Althea Erickson, 24 of Manhattan, and Jessica Eisen, 23 of Brooklyn, were charged with disturbing the peace and the flyers were removed. According to the Greenwich Times newspaper, the public disturbance charge against Nixon was based on his chauffeuring the women to the neighborhood. Eisen and Erickson were also charged with violating a town ordinance against posting bills on public property. The activists said they felt the police set an unreasonably high bond of $1,153 and were expected to pay fines of $75 for each of the 14 flyers they posted. The American Civil Liberties Union of Connecticut is looking into the arrests to determine if they violated free speech rights. Annette Lemereau, a Connecticut ACLU attorney, said the arrest suggested selective enforcement based on the political content of the posters. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Anna Manzo. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Since the January 30th election in Iraq, which saw a higher-than-expected turnout among Shiite and Kurdish voters, the White House and some major corporate media outlets have been crediting President Bush for what's been characterized as a wave of democracy spreading across the Middle East. The wars launched by Mr. Bush in Afghanistan and Iraq and public pressure on authoritarian governments have been cited by some pundits as an important factor in moves towards democracy taking place in Lebanon, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Palestinian territories. But other analysts point out that movements supporting democracy predate Mr. Bush's invasions, and in some cases have been hurt by a post-anti-war Washington backlash. Critics also say that the White House has refused to pressure anti-democratic regimes, such as those in Pakistan and some former Soviet states that have cooperated with the Bush administration's war on terrorism. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the claim that White House policy is responsible for some tentative progress toward democracy in the Middle East. She also looks at Mr. Bush's nomination of John Bolton to be the next U.S. ambassador to the U.N., despite his long record of hostility toward the world body.
Well, I think it's enormous chutzpah, if you will, for George Bush to claim credit for what Egyptians and Lebanese and Syrians and Palestinians and others across the Arab world have been fighting for so many years, with the U.S. standing as the bulwark against their fight. There was, a very prescient statement the other day from the Egyptian feminist and novelist Nawal Sadawi. She said, describing this effort of Bush to claim credit for all of this, she said, "This is a new kind of imperialism. Now they don't only steal our land and our resources, but they steal our struggle as well." And I thought that was a very telling way of talking about it, that it's this notion of stealing credit for something. It's really very insulting to people across the Middle East, the people that Bush claims to be defending, by essentially denying that their decades-long struggles against their own military government or absolute monarchy, backed by the United States, crucially, the only thing that kept them in power, that somehow none of that matters, and all that matters is that Bush has invaded Iraq, and that's what made it all possible. Certainly, I mean, we can't be foolish. There is a major historical shift going on in the Middle East, I think a very dangerous one. And the question of how long-standing struggles for democracy will be affected by that shift is a serious question that needs serious analysis. But the kind of off-the-cuff claim that, well, none of this would be possible if we hadn't invaded Iraq, is just specious. It's just not true.
Phyllis Bennis, the neoconservatives in the White House certainly believe the Iraq War serves as an example of what could befall countries that don't cooperate with the United States. In terms of some of the small moves being made by these countries, is it simply to placate the Bush administration, or is there something genuine occurring in these countries?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. You're certainly right, Scott, that this is a moment when the Bush administration is making clear that no government anywhere in the world is safe from being invaded, occupied, overturned, bombed, if the Bush administration decides that they are not what they want them to be. I mean, there's no sense of international law playing any role here. The Bush administration has claimed for itself the right, because we have the might, they have claimed the right to do whatever they want to whatever government around the world that they choose. So that's a very, very serious threat. And the rhetorical threats have been ratcheted up quite high recently. You know, on the one hand, it's urging Hosni Mubarak in Egypt to release Ayman Nour from prison is pretty easy. Now, we should note that Ayman Nour, the one political prisoner that the U.S. has taken under its wing and has made a very big fuss about, appropriately, because he was arrested for no reason. It was a clear violation of human rights. But he is the leader of a small pro-U.S. party in Egypt. There are massive numbers of political prisoners in Egypt about whom the U.S. has nothing to say. And frankly, until we see some evidence that at least part of the $2 billion annual U.S. aid to Egypt is being held back, conditional on a significant opening of Egypt's political and economic system, there's really no basis to take seriously the White House claims that it is somehow supporting Egyptian democracy. The fact that after a sort of rhetorical slap on the wrist, really, to Saudi Arabia, the Saudi royals decided that they would allow a partial election for really powerless municipal councils in which not only men can vote, but only half the candidates are to be elected at all. The other half are to be officially appointed. And those who run for office have to be vetted by the royal family. So the notion that this is somehow a democratic opening, it's not really accurate.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, before we conclude, I wanted to ask you briefly to comment on President Bush's nomination of John Bolton to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He's generally viewed as someone who's hostile to the United Nations, to say the least. What does that say about the Bush foreign policy in this second term?
Well, it says that anyone who believed that the second term was going to be one of moderation rather than extremism, this is pretty wrong. This is yet another case of punishing the realists and rewarding the rabid. You know, when it comes to spelling, John Bolton seems even worse than Dan Quayle. He seems to think that UN is a four-letter word. This is a serious insult not only to the United Nations itself, but to every American, the vast majority of whom support the United Nations, despite efforts by the Bush administration and some in Congress to persuade us not to. Most Americans do support the UN. John Bolton is a man who once said, "There is no United Nations. When the United States leads," he said, "the United Nations will follow. When it suits our interests to do so, we will do so. When it does not suit our interests, we will not." He has no acknowledgement, not only that the UN has any legitimacy, but that international law has any legitimacy. His view is that United States sovereignty, as he puts it, the protection of U.S. interests, is the only legitimate interest in the world, and that the United Nations should be seen solely as a tool of that American policy. And if it doesn't suit our interests, it has no legitimate basis for even being.
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. 1 year ago, rebel attacks against the government of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide led to the February 29th overthrow of that Caribbean nation's first democratically elected president. The former Catholic priest charged that he was the victim of a political kidnapping carried out by the members of the United States military when he was taken aboard an American plane and forced into exile in the Central African Republic. Mr. Aristide was later given political asylum in Jamaica and now resides in South Africa. Haiti's Washington-installed Prime Minister, Gérard Latortue, has imprisoned hundreds of officials and supporters of Mr. Aristide's overthrown government, including former Prime Minister Yvon Neptune and Interior Minister Joselin Privert. Both men, detained since June 27th without charge, have undertaken a hunger strike in protest. Neptune, who was hospitalized on March 10th for treatment of severe dehydration, has vowed to continue his fast until he's released. California Congresswoman Maxine Waters visited Haiti on March 7th with a delegation of American human rights advocates and met with Neptune and Prevert. The Democratic representative expressed grave concern about the deplorable prison conditions and the human rights situation she observed in Haiti. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Congresswoman Waters about her fact-finding trip to Haiti and her criticism of Bush administration policy toward that troubled island nation.
We learned that Yvon Neptune, the former prime minister under President Aristide, was in prison and was on a hunger fast. We knew he had been arrested some time ago, but we became worried about him because we learned that not only was he on the hunger fast, by that time he had been on it, I guess, almost 2 weeks. So I went to Haiti along with some other people to basically see about him, to see what his health condition was, and to try and encourage him to either discontinue the strike or certainly try to encourage the United States government to assist him in getting him out of jail. And so I traveled there and was able to visit with him. He was very weak when I visited him, and he was just talking above a whisper. And I held a press conference, and I let everybody know that I thought that he was in danger. I talked to our embassy personnel down there. I sent a letter to Condoleezza Rice, to the President of the United States. And when I returned, I sent out more information describing his condition. Well, since that time, he's been moved to a UN hospital, and I understand that he's doing better. And I'm anxiously waiting more information, even today as I fly into Washington.
As your delegation reported, there are many political prisoners being held by the government of Gerard Latortu, which was installed by the U.S. military after the coup 1 year ago. What is the situation for political prisoners in general in Haiti?
The conditions are absolutely deplorable. And we did visit with former Minister Prevert, who's in prison, who also has started a hunger fast. We visited with other political prisoners. I had a chance to talk with a young man named Jacques Matiplier, who had served as counsel to President Aristide at one time. He was in prison in filthy conditions. He was guilty of nothing. He had not been charged with anything. They simply had arrested him because of his relationship to President Aristide. We had been hearing these stories about members of the Lavalas Party, President Aristide's political party, being thrown in jail, like Soan, the very popular singer and humanitarian that's also in prison. We didn't get a chance to see her. Not only are they being thrown into prison, a lot of Lavalas members have been killed, particularly in cities, Soleil and Bel Air, and some of the very poor areas. So I think that there is an attempt to literally get rid of Lavalas leaders so that when they hold this fake election they are planning, they won't have anybody to run representing the Lavalas party. So I think it's an effort to, silence them prior to this election they plan on holding. The United States has to accept responsibility for Latortu. He's basically our puppet. And so I'm calling on the United States to accept responsibility and see to it that these political prisoners are released and provide some real security for them.
Congresswoman Waters, have you been in touch with ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide lately? He's in South Africa, I believe. What are his plans, if any? Do you know?
Well, yes, I've been in touch with him, and he is working to see what he can do to get South Africa and CARICOM and the AU involved in helping Haiti, particularly if there are going to be any elections. We believe and he believes that it's very important that a number of countries get involved to try and help organize and implement true free and fair election in Haiti. So I know that that's foremost on his mind.
Congresswoman Waters, President Bush has been using his office, the presidency, to promote democracy all around the world, particularly the Middle East has been a focus of his administration in recent months. How do you square the rhetoric coming out of the White House with the U.S. policy towards Haiti?
Well, anybody who observes our relationship to Haiti would soon conclude that we really don't care about Haiti, that if there's any stepchild of the foreign relations agenda of America, it's Haiti, despite the fact it's right here in the Western Hemisphere, right here next door to us. We have disrespected Haiti in every way. We have a discriminatory immigration policy toward Haiti. We have abandoned Haiti and left it to, Brazilian forces who know little or nothing about the culture and basically are there for political reasons in an attempt to get the support of the United States so that President Lula can serve on the Security Council at the UN And so all that I can explain is it's a black country of poor people who mean little or nothing to the United States of America. Democracy is about letting the people decide. The people decided they wanted to elect and did elect Mr. Aristide, and the United States assisted in removing him. And that certainly doesn't speak to our support for democracy. So, yeah, there's a contradiction in what they say and what they do.
That was California Congresswoman Maxine Waters. For more information, call her office at area code 202-225-2201 or visit her website at www.house.gov/waters. In 2002, the Bush administration introduced their so-called Clear Skies Initiative, which would have rewritten the bedrock Clean Air Act passed more than 30 years ago. The legislation, which Washington observers say was written by industry, would have tilted the law to favor polluters and away from protecting public health by reducing toxic emissions as quickly as possible. The bill also would have done nothing to regulate greenhouse gases, a major cause of global warming. But after 3 years of trying, the Republican-controlled Congress has been unable to get the bill out of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, where it died on a 9-9 vote. But the administration immediately activated regulations that implement many of the same things to weaken enforcement that the failed legislation was designed to do. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with John Walk, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Clean Air Program, about these regulations, one of which regulates interstate air pollution, and another will deal with extremely toxic mercury emissions that Walk warns are especially harmful.
Now, this rule is truly one of the worst rules ever to be signed by EPA. It is a dangerous, dishonest, and illegal effort that ensures that the American people will be exposed to excessive and dangerous levels of mercury pollution from power plants for at least the next two decades. This is especially inexcusable considering that mercury is a dangerous neurotoxin that affects the developing brain of young children and the developing fetus. The Bush administration essentially kowtowed to the power plant industry and adopted a rule that will give them far too long to continue polluting and that will fail to protect the American people.
With all these emissions, isn't the guiding principle what's called cap and trade?
EPA rules rely upon a pollution trading scheme for mercury, nitrogen, and sulfur pollution, just as the Clear Skies legislation relied upon a trading program for those three pollutants as well.
But hasn't cap and trade proven to be quite effective in cleaning up sulfur and nitrogen pollution in the past?
There's actually very little, if any, opposition to pollution trading approaches for smog and soot pollution. We've had a successful program addressing acid rain that uses a trading approach, and my organization, the Natural Resources Defense Council, supported that program, and we support responsible trading programs for smog and soot from power plants today. But the key is responsible. The Bush administration is using the friendly label of a pollution trading approach, which is sensible if correctly done, really as cover for an approach that gives the power plant industry alone an additional two decades to continue polluting at excessive and harmful levels. We could all agree that a pollution trading program that requires very deep reductions by a few years from now would be very protective of public health, but that's far, far from what the Bush administration is doing. So the objection of public health groups is not to trading programs per se. It is instead to using trading programs as an excuse for giving industry 20 years to solve a problem that they can solve today with available technology and to do so cost effectively.
Wouldn't industry just pass on the cost of cleaning up pollution to consumers anyway?
Well, that's an excellent question. One would think, especially in a highly regulated industry like the utility sector, that the cost could be passed along to ratepayers. In fact, we know that if utilities were to clean up their mercury poisoning by 90% within the next 3 to 5 years, that the average cost to electric customers would be on the order of $1 to $3 per month on their electricity bill. Now, with the utility industry also being deregulated in recent years, in fact, those costs are not always passed on directly to ratepayers. My view is that it's a combination of the utility industry being opened up to market forces where they're not as easily able to recapture those costs, in their view, and frankly, just a combination of ideology and opposition to regulation generally.
Regarding mercury emissions specifically, from 1990 to 1999, airborne mercury emissions in the U.S. dropped by almost half to 113 tons. Can you explain how it dropped so quickly?
Absolutely. The Clinton administration in the 90s issued two regulations requiring over 90% reductions from two types of incinerators, medical waste incinerators and hazardous waste incinerators, both of which have had at the time pretty significant mercury emissions, not nearly as much as coal-fired power plants. And EPA set an aggressive rule, and industry complained that technology was not available or that it was too costly, and in fact those complaints were wrong, and we've experienced very deep reductions in mercury from those two industrial sectors. We can and should do the same thing here. We should require on the order of 90% reductions in mercury pollution from coal-fired power plants, which at 48 tons is the largest industrial sector in the United States still polluting at that level. Mercury pollution in the United States puts an estimated 600,000 newborn children at risk from harmful levels of mercury poisoning, according to the Center for Disease Control and data from the Food and Drug Administration. This is a public health crisis in this country, and the largest remaining sector of industry in this country that has escaped regulation for its mercury pollution is power plants.
That was John Walk, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Clean Air Program. For more information, call the council at area code 202-289-6868 or visit their website at www.nrdc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minet, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.